You are listening to Wind Bands of Every Flavor, a podcast for directors and musicians dedicated to concert, marching, and jazz bands throughout the world. And now, your host, Chad Nicholson.
This is your host of Wind Bands of Every Flavor, Dr. Chad Nicholson, coming to you from Indiana University, Purdue University, in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today is a very special episode where I'm welcoming a couple of my colleagues, and we're going to sit around and talk about music. It's getting to be that time where you need to get those music orders in for the fall, and we're going to do everything we can to help you in every facet of your music selection for the concerts that are coming up this year. Don't forget that you can catch me at windbands@gmail.com, or you can go over to the website at chadnicholson.wordpress.com, or of course you can catch me at facebook.com/drchadnicholson. Today I'm welcoming two very knowledgeable band directors to the repertoire roundtable, Mr. Matthew Arau and Dr. Matt Brunner. Let's start by introducing the folks who will be joining me today. We'll start with Matt Brunner. Matt is a conductor at Temple University in Philadelphia. He's also the NBA Eastern Division Chair and the Pennsylvania State Representative. He does clinics all over the country. Most recently, he presented at the CBDNA Marching Band Convention. Let's welcome Matt Brunner to the podcast. Dr. Brunner, tell us a little bit about your presentation at the CBDNA convention, the Athletic Band Symposium.
It's an Athletic Band Symposium, so it's athletic band directors from all around the country, and it's really a fantastic event. Everyone who's put it on in the past and this year, we were out at Arizona State, and it was just a fantastic event. A lot of good socialization time with each other. There's a golf outing and, you know, some good dinners together and all that. But the session that I presented, it was myself and Melvin Miles from Morgan State. And it was the session was choreography, adding choreography to your marching band performance, which was kind of different. And having the both of us with two different perspectives, Morgan State is an HBC school, and as Melvin said in his shows, he said they have to dance, or he might get fired. And with me coming to Temple, I came and I had a background at Ohio University in bands that did dances, and so I kind of introduced that a little bit at Temple, and the first time I introduced it here, everyone was very much, I don't know about this, but the crowd loved it. And so once that happened, then they were hooked.
And the other person we'd like to welcome to the podcast today is
a familiar voice on this podcast, Mr. Matthew Arau. If you've listened to the podcast in the past, we talked to Matthew. He's the director of bands at Loveland High School, which is situated just between Fort Collins and Boulder out in Colorado. And his bands out at Loveland have won championships both in the marching and concert realms. His group has performed at a variety of conventions, including the Western International Band Clinic in Seattle. He's also a very important person in the American Band College, ABC, and he's also the Western Region Representative for the ASBDA. I was wondering, Matthew, first of all, welcome.
Thank you, Chad. It's great to be here.
About an update. How did things go at the American Band College? And then also the ASBDA, if you have any information you can give us about that from this summer.
The summer at American Band College was very rewarding. We had some wonderful people as teachers and guest conductors. Featured Alan Gladys Wright, Colonel Arnold Gabriel, Frank DeKelly, Peter Boonshaft, Robert W. Smith, and Robert Ponto. And just had a wonderful summer. During ABC, we experienced the loss of a great music educator and a great friend to many of us, Bruce Dinkins. And so as often is the case, music was our voice to share our sorrow through our instruments. But music also lifts the spirit.
Well, I'm sure that was a challenging time, and it sounds like the musicians came together as best they could. Can you tell us a little bit about the ASBDA convention in Denver?
Yeah, we had the ASBDA Western Region 1 conference this summer in Denver, and David Holsinger was a guest. and had a wonderful time with him. He presented on Then and Now and maybe some of the changes that have happened in the band world, and not to forget that the reason we came to teach band was because of passion. So always keep the passion within your teaching and make sure your students understand that. He was talking about some changes in his own conducting, and he just talked about how, you know, he was, because of his intense passion, he's really used his full upper body and then from the shoulder, you know, conducting from the shoulder a lot. But he's gotten into Le Bon technique, and it's helped him to, you know, physically be able to conduct more without pain, and help with clarity as well.
They would probably be able to see a lot of that in his conducting, you know, high energy, you know, and fun, definitely fun and full of passion. Yeah. Again, sincerely appreciate Matthew and Matt joining the show today. The whole point of today's podcast is to give band directors a chance to reflect on some ideas for repertoire as they start to get things ready for the coming school year. And we're going to talk about things that it's not all going to be grade 5, grade 6, and it's not all going to be grade 2 and 3 either. We've got a nice spread of pieces that I think most people could at least grab one or two ideas, or at least spark a few other ideas. This is not a definitive list. I think if we got together in 30 days and did it again, we'd have all different pieces. These are just some ideas about some things that are on the top of our minds right now, and hopefully not every director will have heard every tune that we're going to talk about today, so you can walk away with a few ideas. So what we did is we split it into categories of openers and slow tunes, big pieces, and then a closer or a march or dance piece. We might even have time to talk about solo pieces or suites or obscure pieces or even transcriptions. So we're going to try to touch on quite a few things today. And we hope that the band directors who listen to this will come away with some great new ideas and feel invigorated with the opportunities that they can create some great performances with their ensembles. So I'll kick it off with the subject of openers. And openers, you know, it can be a tricky beast. Do you want to do a short opener that's fast and loud and get the attention of the audience? That's fairly traditional. Or do you want to really demonstrate some skills, some chops, and have it be a little more sophisticated piece? And one of the tunes that I threw out there is To Walk With Wings by Julie Giroux, which is a little more on the slightly more sophisticated side. It's a little longer piece, probably in the 7 to 8 minute category. But the reason I selected that one is, number one, it starts with a really nice brass fanfare, a good attention getter. You can have your brass stand up for it. But then it is truly programmatic. And I'm not the most enthusiastic supporter of always doing programmatic music, because I know there's a lot of it out there. And I know that sometimes it's easy to tell a story to the audience to engage them. And sometimes that distracts from the music in and of itself. And sometimes I think it's nice to just be able to appreciate music for what it is. However, Julie Giroux does it right with this, because she takes the listener through the earliest primal flight. This is written for the Air Force Band, so early flight, people jumping off cliffs with wings strapped to their backs. And then it goes through the woodworking and metal, the metal era, the Industrial Revolution, and then it gets all computery, and then it ends with the space shuttle. And she really commits to the program. But it's pretty. It's nice. It's very almost cinematic. So for a lot of groups in kind of that grade four and a half area, this would be a nice kickoff to a concert. It would not fit the bill if you're really looking for a 3 minute just go out and blow, or go out and kick kind of piece. It's not that. It takes a little more time to develop than that. And then the other one that I had thrown down was, I'd been talking about Candide. I think maybe it was Matt that put Slava on our list, which have a lot of similarities. I think it was Ray Kramer who said 7 or 8 years ago something about Candide, something to the effect of, you know, every time you pull up Candide, there's always something to work on. You're never finished with it. And it's one of those tunes that it's fun to listen to and play. And same thing as Slava. But there can be a lot of stuff to work on there. Matt, was it Slava that you had thrown down on our list?
I don't know if I put it on there, but I've, you know, I've done both those pieces before. Just recently, I did Candide. Just actually our last concert, and did it as a closer. But yeah, I agree with Candide, man. There's the lot of things to work on in that piece. And, you know, it's a fun piece to listen to. It's one that, you know, it's always a crowd pleaser. But there's a lot of technical things, a lot of musical things you can work on.
Now, Matthew, I know you did Candide with your high school ensemble a few years ago. What were your perspectives on that experience?
Well, the kids love the piece. It's great to have them hear the original and, you know, hear the lyrics and see how the music evolves. It's a big challenge in terms of keeping the motor locked in. So you have to get really, really tight rhythmically, just all the upbeats lining up with the downbeats. But that's, I think the motor is the biggest challenge of that. And then, of course, there's the exposure to the woodwind soloists in the center. So you need some, you know, strong double reeds and piccolo and whatnot. So it definitely exposes your band.
Matt, did you have any other openers that you like to do?
One that I've done recently and actually done a couple times is Mask by Kenneth Hesketh. That's kind of, I don't know, it came out about 2000, and it's a very bombastic opener. You know, it starts off with this real nice horn, almost fanfare, but it's more of the melody or the thematic material that is used throughout. And you know, it's one of those fast and loud, grabs you. It's a lot of thick scoring throughout. And I remember Tim Rainish kind of complaining about that one time. But it was, you know, it's a lot of nice moments. The tempo continues throughout the entire piece at the same. There's a 6/8 section in the middle that it really jumps right from the 3/4 to the 6/8, and there's a trumpet solo there. It's really the only major solo in the piece. There's a couple of small isolated moments, but it's about if I remember right, it's about 7 minutes long. So it's a little bit longer, considering as an opener. There's a lot of technical things to it too. There's some good fingering work for the woodwinds. The brass range kind of gets up there. The trumpets can get up there and stay up there. The horns are up there pretty high as well. But it's a really fun piece. It's a difficult piece. You know, it's probably grade 5, or, you know, could be a little more. A high school group could do it if it's a very good high school group.
Matthew, now I remember a piece you did back in the day, Red Rocks Fanfare. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
I like this one. I was looking for an opener for a concert that was different from your typical fanfare. And when I think of a fanfare, I often think of mostly a brass feature, which can be great. But when I discovered Red Rocks Fanfare, I enjoyed it because it featured all the sections of the band, had a lot of woodwind exposure, percussion exposure, as well as, you know, your natural trumpet, trombone section features. The whole piece is just about 2 minutes and 15 seconds long, and there's a lot of material. I find it really musical. It's about a grade 4, and so appropriate for high school bands, and there's enough grit in it to work on for the woodwinds, enough 16th notes and challenge there. It's a lot of fun, and I found it's just a great reward. You know, sometimes I like to open up a concert with a march, like Florentiner March is a great one that comes to mind off the bat.
Matt, what do you think about, are people playing marches here? What's going on?
Well, I think people started getting away from marches quite a bit, but then there seemed to be a push. You know, people would give the presentations at conventions about marches and march style and keep playing marches. They're very American, you know, and I think they kind of came back. And so people are, you know, doing at least a march every once in a while. Maybe not every concert, but, you know, a lot of them are doing maybe one a year. And I think it's good. You know, marches are always crowd pleasers, and it gets it going. When I was in Ohio teaching, and we would go to the state festivals, everybody had to do a march or a slow piece, and most people chose to do a march. and that was always mm-hmm. their opener. So that was the warm up.
Yeah. Matthew, how often do you program a march? I mean, do you do one a year, or one a semester, or how often do you like to do them?
We probably do about 3 marches a year. I try to find marches that I personally find really interesting. And mm-hmm. we did Hands Across the Sea this past year, and I just found it really interesting. If there's a march that has maybe a mallet feature in it, just something to, mm-hmm. to make it a little bit different. You know, that's why like Florentine is so interesting to me, because it's definitely not your typical march. And, but I think marches have gotten a bad name, but really when you work on a march with some of the masters, as we've gotten to do like at ABC, working with Colonel Gabriel or, you know, somebody like that, or Lowell Graham, or, you know, Alan Gladys Wright, they just know what they want. Mm-hmm. And even working with Frank Wicks on marches, it was really exciting.
Yeah. Just a lot of those guys, you know, I don't want to say the older generation, but, you know, they really know their marches. They really can take you through marches. I remember Ken Bloomquist working with our group one time, and it was just a fantastic experience. He actually took it one day, took the march and played it in halftime, and played it as a chorale,
mm-hmm.
just to show how the harmonies move and just how interesting the inside parts are in a march, and how fast those harmonies go by, and to really understand how it works.
I was just going to say, mentioning bringing the or playing the march at halftime, turning it into a chorale, is what Ira Hirshen did with the Symphony.
Oh man, that is such a great piece of music.
And that piece, I love that piece.
Gosh,
each movement is incredible. We specifically worked on After the Thunderer, and you know Mahler with Sousa in that piece, and you really grow an appreciation of, as you mentioned, Matt, the chord progressions and the beauty.
Boy, you know, there are so many marches that a lot of people don't do anymore. You know, I have that whole book of, I'm sure a lot of people do, the March Music Melodies, that is just the first trumpet parts of all these. I feel like some people are, you know, some people are starting to bring out some more marches and write some more. There's some composers for some of the younger bands have come out with marches recently.
Yeah, a great example would be the John Mackey pseudo march called Xerxes, which is playable by a wide range of bands, and you know, it's based upon the movie 300. So I, you know, Sousa 300, it's close. You know how it is when you take a good old piece of music and you believe in it, and then you pass something out, and those noses wrinkle, and they haven't heard one note, or maybe all they've heard is sight reading the piece. And they just immediately say, I don't like that. And I always say, you don't like what you just played, but you didn't play it. You just read it. And sure. I, especially when I taught high school, I felt with marches, there was a lot of nose wrinkling. Not as much with the college kids that I teach in Indiana, but still, you know, the Xerxes is at least a kind of a bridge piece. You know, it's at least can help show, okay, here's a style. Now we can take that style. I think you have to follow it up, though. And now we take that style and let's apply it to this Sousa march or Fillmore or something like that. But it is, and it's again, you know, it sounds like 300, you know, and so, and it's, and that one is actually good for a younger group because it's got a lot of repetition. So if you can get the style down, they do it 1,000 times. Then when they pull up the Sousa, ideally they'd be able to transfer that style. So I agree with you that there's some positive to younger bands having a chance to play new music that is a kind of a bridge like that. Matt, let's talk about slow pieces. Do you have any chorale style pieces that you like?
I said when I was in Ohio, we had the choice of either doing a march or a chorale. And at that point in time in my life, for some reason, I enjoyed doing chorales, and everybody thought I was crazy. But this also works on intonation problems. You know, it's not all about the judges. Yeah. It's about, you know, developing your students can do.
We'll have to bleep most of
that's it. That's another episode all by itself, I'm sure. One time I did Nimrod, the Alfred Reed version.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they loved it. Honestly, they loved it. they really had a good time with it, just because it's such a powerful piece of music, and they really enjoyed it. As summer was just beginning, did that one. It was very nice. Recently, right. I did with one. An honor band, Resting in the Peace
yeah, that's
of His Hands.
Really nice. Pretty much any band level, I mean, you know, reasonably speaking, can play it. And it's there are a lot of tunes like this. I mean, we could probably count five or six mm-hmm. right off the top of our heads that are pieces that a large number of bands can do. But really, it's about how far you can take them musically, and of course, intonation and moving together and flow and things like that. But you know, there are things like even you know Ray Kramer would always talk about Air for Band as being just a great piece for Erickson, you know, or Blessed Are They, you know, when I was at IU, you know, someone brought up Ammerland by De Haan, and that's just a very nice, pretty piece, you know, and I think that the simplicity, in the simplicity, we can really find complex musicianship, and I think it's a great challenge. Again, though, it's, I don't know about you guys, but sometimes we fight that, you know, they see easy notes, they see easy rhythms, and they think, okay, we're done, you know, got that. And so I guess my question, maybe Matthew, you could take this, is mm-hmm. when you're doing a chorale style piece, how do you keep the intensity up?
Well, that's a great question. I actually find that my high school students love sharing their emotion in music. And oftentimes they're drawn towards the really expressive piece, particularly if there's a story mm-hmm. Behind it and they understand the meaning. I think the students have so much to express. And in general, I think my students love doing the expressive pieces. Sometimes they'll beg for those kinds of pieces where they could just pour their heart out. And, you know, if you're doing a lot with the music in terms of shaping it and focusing on the blend and not just playing in tune, but making decisions on what color we want to have dominate and involving the students in those decisions and hearing the different mix, I find they get really, really excited. About it. Obviously, like a piece like Elegy for a Young American, the intensity of the emotion behind that is incredible. Mm-hmm. I find that the students can really like it. I often wonder about the demands for percussion on the slow pieces. One thing, you can pick a piece that doesn't have a whole lot of percussion, and there's obviously wonderful pieces. Contra Key Rose, Omanium Mysterium, or two recent transcriptions that I was thinking about, of course, with Quiet Courage. Another Larry Dan piece is great. You can give the percussionist a score, and so that they can be mm-hmm. following along and then use them up in the front of the room to offer musical comments. Mm-hmm. And I like to do that a lot with the percussion. But then the other trick is to find a chorale or a lyrical piece that has percussion parts.
That's a nice
and
one.
One piece I'd like to recommend is Song for Lindsay by Andrew Boyson. Yeah, and I like it because the percussion are involved and there's challenging parts for them. And it mm-hmm. adds to the totality of the piece. They're not just added as an afterthought, like they're really important.
Yeah, there are some pieces out there that they try to involve the percussion, but it's so out of place. Sometimes I'll do the lyrical piece at the beginning of the rehearsal, and you know the percussion, they're finishing setting up or you know, go take a bathroom break at the beginning or whatever, you know, just so they're mm-hmm. once they get into rehearsal they don't have a big lag there. But I try mm-hmm. to, you know, kind of do my best to stick with the time mm-hmm. schedule so that they can, you know, take part when they need to. You know, it's important for them. I like what Matthew said about you know, giving them a score. Because you know, in my situation, mm-hmm. a lot of the kids they're going to be band directors, and so it's not just about them playing, it's about them learning the pieces and learning the inside and outs. And you know, I tell the kids at the beginning of the semester, you know, mm-hmm. Fred Fennell, he'd sit back there on the timpani and he'd play the whole piece from the score, and he'd follow the score, so he learned the piece.
Matthew, what are some thoughts that you have on a kind of a main piece, whether it's for a festival or even just for a concert that is not taken outside of your auditorium?
Yeah, so the thing about the big mm-hmm. piece is it may not always be appropriate for festival because of the time constraints. And so a couple of the pieces that I wanted to mention might be too long. The new piece that just came out recently is at Kitty O'Shea's, Johann de May. Mm-hmm. and it's about 17 minutes long. But it is very exciting. It can involve auxiliary instruments like harp, guitar, banjo, spoons, and accordion even. But that if you don't have those instruments, I've performed it both ways with the additional instruments and without. It's still really exciting, and it uses themes from Ireland. It was premiered at the American Band College 1 year ago, and then my band performed it at the Western International Band with Johan conducting last November. And a huge crowd pleaser. But I've used that piece on the front end of a concert and as the last piece on a concert, and it works both ways really well. Another piece that I've done recently is Angels in the Architecture, Frank DeKelly. And I think it works well in the center of the program because of the soft ending. It ends with the voice singing very softly. But, you know, I guess I could say Kitty O'Shea's is very challenging for the woodwinds. It's definitely like grade 6. Angels in the Architecture is listed as a grade 4, though it's probably more of a grade 5. But it's definitely more playable and approachable. And it's so interesting with the crystal wine glasses.
Now, Matt, there are state lists that allow bands to just play selected movements out of pieces, and sometimes bands do just arrangements of bigger works. What do you think of this practice?
I have heard of, you know, middle school bands that have done a movement, the first movement of Lincolnshire Posy or something like that. They have some really good players. I'm a little mixed on splitting it up. I think for school groups, just so the kids get the experience, so the students have the experience of playing, some really fine one of the whole suites or parts of the whole suite or Lincolnshire Posy or something like that. I think it's okay to split it up.
Well, let's talk about suites for a second. You know, we have the whole suites, English Folk Song Suite, an original suite. Matthew, how often do you pull out the classic standard suites?
And how do they react, high school kids? How do they react to, you know, the whole second suite?
Well, for example, we did the first suite on the 100th anniversary, and that became the kids' favorite piece, which I was delighted by. They absolutely loved it. And so I think that that's something we can learn from, is that the classics are still, they still have that depth and that magic in them that the kids 100 years later still love them to death. And I think the same thing with Lincolnshire. Even if you just do a movement or two, the kids really can recognize quality. And it's a different sound than what the contemporary pieces are. Like, in fact, I guess my students are at the point now where they're begging me to do Granger every year. They're like, can we do another Granger? We did Gumsucker's March, and that, I guess, I could have put under the March category. This year we did Molly on the Shore, and the students just love the sound of Granger as they do Holst. It's fresh to them, which is interesting for us to think about, because we think, oh, it's a classic, it's been around forever, it's a standard. But the kids don't hear those sounds anymore, so it actually could be a new release as far as they're concerned.
Granger is just brilliant in how he wrote for band. He was so ahead of his time, and it still is just a fantastic sound. Everything that he does and the way he writes.
Yeah, really rich sounds. Now, speaking from an adjudicator standpoint, sometimes band directors will program a whole suite, and then they'll play something that is ultra contemporary, almost sounds like it could have come off a marching band field, but turned into a concert band piece. I don't know if you guys know that kind of piece that I'm talking about, but it's got all the conventions of a marching band opener. And that's fine, but it's a very drastic contrast. And I often feel like I can hear the kids playing it as they play it, invest themselves into the more outside sounding piece because it's something that they recognize. It's a style that they recognize and can do immediately. And a lot of times when I clinic those bands, I'll say, hey, which one of these did you like better? Did you like the Holst better or the whatever the other piece is better? And usually when they all raise their hands for the fast, loud somewhat marching band convention piece, I'll tell them, hey, you know what, guys, how could I tell that? I could tell which one you liked better, but I shouldn't be able to. You know, we should be investing ourselves equally in both pieces, because they both bring something to the table, albeit very different things. But I think that you brought up, Matthew, that if your students love playing whole suite, I mean, that is, I think for some kids, half the battle is to get them to embrace a different sound. I mean, if it's at 100 years old, put on a popular music from 100 years ago, it's completely different. And there's, a very crafty challenge to convincing students to appreciate the things in a whole suite in the same way that they can appreciate, a 5-1 triple F, you know, finish to a piece, you know?
Yeah. I think you've hit it right on. It's part of it is, you know, they go from marching band and they work on that music. And then when they get to concert band, mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of bands that still think they're out on the marching band field. And the thing about technique is a lot of people push technique and they think technique involves fingers and articulation and volume, you know, but there's tone quality that is something that is really, really overlooked. And, mm-hmm. you know, articulation right. that is focused on is just accents, making sure the accents are there, but they don't look at the staccatos and legatos and then all of the nuances of each one of those that can happen that make the style of the piece. That's what's missing, I think.
Convince students to find ways to think about what the sound is, as well as their fingers and their tongue and their articulations and the beginnings of notes, but also the ends of notes and where those notes are leading. How, you know, are they leading to the next note, or is it leading to four measures from now? You know,
I was just going to say that's such a big one, the ends of notes. I saw Gary Green work with the group one time, and he told the group, find the beauty in your sound on the release. And that stuck with me more than a lot of things that I've ever heard, because every group that I listened to after that, it was like, mm-hmm. yeah, the students are just starting the note and then they just kind of let it go. Mm-hmm. You know, no big, I started the note, I played it, okay. And it's like they forget about the mm-hmm. ending.
I think it's natural to focus on the front end of notes. We definitely focus on the release, because I absolutely agree with Gary Green and Matt regarding mm-hmm. that resonance is really what we're left with, and intonation mm-hmm. in particular, that's what you hear is at the end of the note, if there's mm-hmm. space,
yep.
hearing beauty or not.
Yeah, and that's the trick, is instead of you as a director, any of us trying to constantly pull students to the ideal that's in our minds, it's if you can get them to be able to conceptualize the ideal, then they start evaluating themselves. Let's move on to closers. We talked about marches, some other ideas. And I'll throw out a couple here. Now, Mike Markowski won the Frank Tichelli composition contest with Shadow Rituals a few years ago, and then he did a follow-up soon after called Instinctive Travels. And there's a similarity there. It's not unlike Legacies by Clint Needham, who also and most recently won the Frank Tichelli Composition Prize. There's a consistency of style there that is appealing to audiences. It's not easy, though. It's technical and very multi-meter, like Tichelli's Wild Nights, I think, may have been a model for that. These three pieces or four pieces. Multimeter, lots of percussion, lots of thick texture. And I would say that while these pieces are kind of a whirlwind and there's a fun element to riding a roller coaster, all of the thick textures in these pieces, it can take a lot of time to help the students play with, they have to play with absolute precision, especially again when things aren't tongued, or when they are tongued and not tongue hard, so that all the textures come together and what you end up with is a clear picture. It's a major challenge. But if the students can achieve that challenge, these types of pieces can be a real barn burner ending. They're fairly, you know, they're not short. All these are kind of in that, you know, 7, 8, 9 minute category, and they take a lot of work, but they can be fun closers. Let's go over to Matthew. Matthew, what are some closers that you enjoy?
I wanted to bring up a piece that was written for the Loveland High School Wind Symphony just recently, and I think it's a fantastic piece. The composer is Greg Simon. The piece is titled Foolish Fire. And it's demanding. It kind of goes in and out of kind of a rock funk groove, but the parts are very independent and ethereal. Center sections in 5/8 with the vibraphone as the motor, and then different solos coming in and out of the motor. But one thing about the piece, we played it at our state convention this past January, and Ray Kramer, after the performance, just asked for the score immediately and was really impressed with the piece, and he plans on apparently doing it with the Mushishina Wind Academy. But if it is a new piece, and I think it's going to have a long life because it's different from a lot of the stuff that's out there. One of his influences is Stephen Bryan. He's a student of Greg Simon is a student of Carter Pan as well, so pretty diverse influences. But that was one piece that came to mind. Another one that is Con, Julie Giroux. It's so much fun. It different styles, opportunities for soloists. The audience gets into it, particularly if the percussionists treat the drums like taiko drums. And
you know, I'm a pretty big supporter of finding little hooks to get the audience smiling on their way out. And, you know, sometimes, you know, students could think that's cheesy, but if they buy into it, it's really fun. It can be a really fun experience. And, you know, we talked about marches and you know, doing Sousa or Xerxes, or, you know, there are the Slavonic dances, or, you know, there are all sorts of fast, quick get up and play kind of piece out there. Albanian dance by Hansen?
Yeah, I put that one in. I heard that at Midwest maybe 5 years ago, and I love this piece. It is it's probably about a grade three, and it sounds so much harder than it really is. There's this constant motor going on. You know, the melody part's just a lot of cut time eighth notes. It sounds really fast and really crazy, but it's a lot easier than what it actually sounds. And so I've used it for, like, I used it with the non-major group here at Temple, and I did it for an honor band that I did with some junior high students, and it's just it really works well, and it's one that it gets your heart pumping. Nice little background groove that's set there. The horns have a fun part.
How about you, Matthew? What are some good closers you've run into?
Another one I was thinking about is sometimes we'll end the final concert with a surround sound piece. We'll bring out our symphonic band and concert band and maybe surround the audience. Yeah. And one that worked particularly effectively was Glorioso by Ito. And we just did the third movement of that. And we brought in the extra bands towards the end and just really cranked it up. And that was really, really a great closer. An older piece that we did in that with a surround sound as well was Mazama. Uh-huh. And that's about a grade three piece. But that's kind of an old one. Jay Chataway, I think.
Chataway, yeah.
Yeah, and that was fun for the audience as well because lots of percussion. So if you have a lot of percussion in your school, you can just surround the audience with tons of percussion. And
great. Let's transition to solo pieces.
Yeah, the new GIA book that's coming out is the Teaching Music Through Performance and Band series is on solos, and I got a chance to work on some of those and came across a couple by Jim Beckel, who's the principal trombone in the Indianapolis Symphony. Glass Bead Game is a concerto for horn that is just wonderful. Really, really nice piece. I had not heard it before. I asked some of the horn players here at Temple if they had, you know, if they knew it. They all knew it right away. It was I want to say it was nominated for a Pulitzer. And it's just a very, very nice piece. I haven't seen the score, so I can't talk past you know, just listening to parts of it. But very, very good. Another one that recently he did was for four horns. It said four or five solo horns in the Mind's Eye, and it's kind of a depicts several paintings, Daniel in the Lion's Den, and some other things. But it's very nice too.
Well, you know, Matt, that reminds me. When I was working on my assigned composers for that GIA book, I ran across a bunch of concertos by Handel.
And I'll tell you, KermitPeters.net, Kermit as in with a K, KermitPeters.net has a ton of concertos for solo, instrument, and wind ensemble by Handel. Trumpet and oboe, alto sax, and he's transcribed these. They're ringing up at $30, $40. So if you wanted to expose your students to that style of music, or you had a soloist, there he has a ton of them over there, and I had no idea about those. So that's an interesting thing that not a lot of people are doing, you know, and very reasonably priced. Matthew, did you have any solo pieces that came to mind?
Solos that were within prior existing mm-hmm. band pieces, like uh-huh. Italian Rhapsody, Julie Giroux, great for clarinet and so on. But mm-hmm. of course, there's like the standard concertino yes. by Weber, yep. Clarinet concertino, which is great.
Let's throw this one, since we're talking to Matthew. Matthew, did you have any other types of pieces that maybe don't fit easily into these other categories?
Well, I did want to mention a piece that mm-hmm. was just published 2010, but it is a transcription, but I think it works really well for band, and it's Samuel Barber's second essay. George Schneider did the transcription, and I think if you're looking for a challenge and getting into the world of transcriptions, but it feels very modern to me, you know, and I think Barber is still such a contemporary, even though it was composed quite a while ago now. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an incredible piece. It was actually recommended to me by Bruce Dinkins.
Now, you mentioned talking to Al and Gladys Wright. What were some of the things that they said about bands playing transcriptions?
Oh, yeah. So Al and Gladys Wright, you know, Gladys is 86 now and Al is 95, but they really had such an impact on the world of band. Al started the NBA and Gladys started the Women's Band Directors Association. And they also founded the John Philip Sousa Foundation and have been the ones that award the Southern Flag of Honor, either for bands or for compositions. And in order to get the Sadler Shield, a band has to do a piece plus a transcription. And what Gladys Wright was telling me is that she feels that bands today don't play transcriptions, mm-hmm. period. And if they do, we don't play them as well as they used to be played. And so I kind of took that as a challenge. and I actually mentioned, hey, we played Samuel Barber's yeah. second essay. She said, that's not really what she had in mind.
Interesting.
More like the Hinesley transcriptions.
What was their take on that? And what's your take on that, Matthew, as far as doing transcriptions, or why they perceive we're not doing them?
Well, I think there might be two reasons why we don't pursue transcriptions readily. One is particularly the demand of transcriptions, and particularly the clarinet section. You have to have depth all the way through to third, sometimes a fourth clarinet section. And there just seems to be less clarinets in bands these days. The second is that as wind ensemble conductors, we're trying to grow our repertoire, and sometimes it's been looked at as pursuing transcriptions as maybe not furthering the art of band, because it's kind of a shout out to the orchestra. And I definitely feel like there was particularly that movement as we've been commissioning, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning composers to write for band. But I guess I would make the argument that it's important for us to get back into doing transcriptions, just the same way that we encourage bands to perform marches that were composed 100 years ago. I personally am taking on that challenge to try to do some more transcriptions from the 19th century with my ensemble. And to try that out, because I think the kids will appreciate it.
Well, I tell you what we'll do is
bring you back on, and you can tell us how that went. Let's close things out, and Matthew, or Matt, we'll start with you on this one. Let's just give our general, if you could pick your overriding guiding principle when you're selecting music for
let's say, coming up in the fall, and you've got your various bands. What is the primary consideration when you're going through, you're listening to things? I assume you're going online, you're checking out audio clips, you're going through the music library, you're trying to remember, you know, what you did last year and what you want to, you know, have variety, and then what you're expecting your ensemble to look like, but we don't always know. You know, in band, that's one of the great mysteries, is what exactly are we going to have on the first day of school, when we see the whites of their eyes, you know, who's going to be there and what instruments are we going to have surplus or a deficiency? Matt, let's start with you. What do you look for when you're picking music?
Probably the biggest thing that I look for is variety. That's probably the most overriding thing that there is, because my view on what we do, you know, the whole art of band, you know, bands came about and is part of the military, and then it moved into the, you know, the Sousa Band was a big entertainment aspect there, and as we've gone on with our, you know, our rep and building that up, and we've looked more towards the artistic side of bands, we still have, you know, those pieces aren't going to reach everybody. And so I try to program something that everybody can latch on to. You know, I want to make sure that there's variety. I want to make sure there's a good opener. I want to make sure there's a slower, lyrical, very musical piece. Make sure there's something big. Make sure there's something contemporary, you know, and a good closer.
How about you, Matthew? You have a very active marching band in the fall. How do you go about selecting concert repertoire early in the school year?
We have a competitive marching program, but we do rehearse a concert music on Wednesdays during the school day, so we just don't rehearse marching band on Wednesdays. And so our concert will be shorter. We'll do an October concert, so that's about 6 weeks of school before we have our first concert. And we've just tried to program some really quality repertoire. Like our second band has done Air for Band, and the first band has done the first suite in October, you know, something like that, maybe a little lighter in terms of the demand. And I agree with Matt, variety is great, and particularly with students, we want to expose them to a broad range of types of repertoire, and certainly students are going to have things that they like the most, and maybe a certain piece is kind of a reward for the students that they can relate to. And then maybe if I'm doing three pieces per band, the second and third piece might be more of a classic. Yeah. where I approach it really enthusiastically, and then they grow to like it, that kind of thing. But, you know, I think the number one thing is I have to like the music. And I was part of a doctoral dissertation, actually, that I used my middle school band, and I was given a script, and I had to tell the kids why the piece was terrible, even though I had to rehearse it. And then another band director had a script that he just kept telling his students why the piece was so excellent. And the students respond to that. If I'm enthusiastic about a piece, generally the students will grow to like it, and vice versa.
Yeah, I have kind of my own personal and odd way of charting out. So I envision a set of three bubbles connected in a triangle. And one bubble is the audience, one bubble is the ensemble, and one bubble is me. And I kind of almost rate each piece as to how big that bubble is for that piece. Is this more audience and students and less me in terms of just my personal reward and investment in it? Or is this one all about, you know, man, I've just always wanted to do, you know, the Gould Symphony or something like that. And so that's one way that I try to ensure variety, is to evaluate each piece in terms of, out of that sacred triangle that is a concert, how is this piece fitting in? But then I also try to look at, you know, I don't always do theme concerts or thematic concerts. I don't know if you guys do. Maybe once a year I'll tie things together intentionally. Sometimes unintentionally it happens. But I would say more often I program to the need of the students and try to not over-program for them, which I feel like, you know, when I'm adjudicating happens a lot. There seems to be a lot of throwing stuff at the kids and saying, well, you know, if I don't challenge them, they'll never grow. Yeah. But I would say more times than not, when they get in that situation, the kids are reaching and reaching, and I don't see them feel successful, and I don't see them making great music.
I try not to overprogram, but I try to do something that's going to challenge the kids that are, you know, that are the stronger players. because I think that's important. With my group, I think the variety aspect is a big thing, but also that they get experience playing the pieces that are classic standard repertoire pieces.
Oftentimes I'll choose a lyrical piece that will be, you know, definitely within their range, but occasionally I will select a piece that might be a stretch for them, and the piece will be a motivator to grow in technique. You know, while I'm aware that we should be approaching it just at their level of technique and then growing musically, sometimes I will have a piece that does stretch them. You know, there's a piece, Arabesque by Samuel Hazo, that has this 30-second section in the woodwinds that's really, really demanding.
Yeah.
But the kids liked it so much that they practiced it like crazy. Mm-hmm. So it's like motivation for practice sometimes. You can use a challenging piece. So I'm kind of in the middle of the road there.
I was going to say, yeah, that's good. I kind of have this an issue sometimes with students that they want to play something harder. They say, I want to play something harder. You know, they have to understand that there's a difference between their technical capabilities of them by themselves, and there's a difference between the technical capabilities of the entire ensemble, and not even just the entire ensemble, but the people who may technically, you can play your own part, mm-hmm. but can you play it with this other part that's going on? And, you know, stylistically correct, they don't look at that part. They're just like, well, I can play my part, so this is too easy for me. But without they play with everybody else, then, you know, they have a different conception of what difficult is. Usually different than what I do.
That's well said, Matt, and a great way to put it. And it's a great way to finish up our podcast today.
Matthew and Matt, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah.
We've gone over quite a bit of information and thrown a lot of ideas for pieces and just general programming things out to directors. And I feel very fortunate that you've given us your time. And I hope very much to bring you back on the program, and maybe we can do a follow-up down the road and talk about different types of pieces of music or different types of ensembles. So I'd like to one more time thank Matt Brunner at Temple University in Philadelphia, and Matthew Rao at Loveland High School in Loveland, Colorado. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Thank you again to Matt Brunner and Matthew Rao for their time and making this a great episode of Wind Bands of Every Flavor. I'll be checking on the response to this podcast. If this is the kind of thing that band directors would like more of, then we can get together again in the future with a different set of panelists, or even bring back the same directors and talk about music and continue to explore all the pieces that can help us and our ensembles. Make sure you swing by the website, chadnicholson.wordpress.com, or drop me an email at windbands@gmail.com. If you're really into repertoire, be sure and check out my book, Guide to the Top 100 Works in Grades 4, 5, and 6, published by Meredith Music. Until next time, this is Chad Nicholson, and as always, remember, tone over tone.